Good afternoon. It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday News. Thank you for listening to KMXT on 100.1 FM. It's your public radio station. Broadcasting from Signal Hill, where it's 35 degrees right now. We're looking for a slight chance of rain showers tonight, mixing with snow after midnight and gradually ending. Mostly cloudy skies overnight with a low of about 31. South wind to 10 miles per hour should turn to the southwest this evening. Coming up on the Midday Report, the Kodiak Area Emergency Services Organization has an update. The state is on the hunt for a scary new COVID-19 variant. Bit of a silver lining for a local grower. And what would you expect a thief to grab when he comes into your house? You might be surprised at what is being stolen in Bethel. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Days from inauguration, the U.S. Capitol is an active crime scene. Today, federal authorities announced where their investigations into the deadly insurrection on the Capitol stand. Michael Sherwin is acting U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia.
We have already opened more than 170 subject files, meaning these individuals have been identified as potential persons that committed crimes on the Capitol grounds, inside and outside. So of those 170 cases that have already been opened, and I anticipate that's going to grow to the hundreds in the next coming weeks, we've already charged over 70 cases.
He says the Department of Justice is looking at significant felony cases tied to sedition and conspiracy. Meanwhile, President Trump does not appear to be taking any responsibility for his role in last week's violence.
Millions of our citizens watched on Wednesday as a mob stormed the Capitol and trashed the halls of government. As I have consistently said throughout my administration, we believe in respecting America's history and traditions, not tearing them down. We believe in the rule of law, not in violence or rioting.
However, Democrats and some members of Trump's own party say the attacks that cost several lives can be traced right back to him and his quest to have the election he lost to Joe Biden overturned. That's why the Democratic-led House is pressing Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove Trump from office now. Pence has shown no sign of going there, so the House will move to again impeach Trump. Here's NPR's Susan Davis.
Once an impeachment resolution passes the House, there has to be a Senate trial once they inform the Senate. There's no way around it. So it is a complicating factor for Democrats of how are they going to balance the likelihood of a Senate trial and the first 100 days of the incoming Biden administration, in which they have a very ambitious agenda they want to get started on, and they really need to get Joe Biden and his cabinet nominees confirmed.
The judge overseeing the trial of former police officers charged in the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis in May has pushed back the trial of three of the officers. We have more from Minnesota Public Radio's John Collins.
The four former officers charged in Floyd's death were scheduled to go on trial in March, but Judge Peter Cahill ruled that two separate trials are required due to COVID-19 restrictions. Former officer Derek Chauvin will keep his March court date. He's charged with murder and manslaughter in Floyd's killing. Three other officers are charged with aiding and abetting murder and manslaughter and are scheduled to go on trial in August. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison's office is prosecuting the former officers. He said in a statement that he disagreed with the judge's decision to have separate trials. For NPR News, I'm John Collins in Minneapolis.
The Dow has closed up 60 points. You're listening to NPR News.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
The Kodiak Area Emergency Services Organization has reported 9 new cases of COVID-19 on Kodiak. Among these were one community transmission case, four close contact cases, and four travel-related cases. This brings the total count for the Kodiak Island Borough to 973 cases since the start of the pandemic. 44 cases are classified as active locally. There have been 39 local hospitalizations to date and 5 deaths. There are currently no active COVID-19 hospitalizations. Alaska scientists are on the hunt for a new, more contagious strain of the coronavirus and they're processing about 100 samples every 5 days at a Fairbanks public health lab. The new type of virus was first found in Britain and could spread as much as 50% faster, although it doesn't appear to make people sicker. Identifying the specific mutation in the new virus was more difficult than simply testing for the presence of the virus itself, and unlike Britain, the U.S. lacks a large-scale program to do what's known as genome sequencing, leaving some states doing minimal testing. Alaska officials say they wish they could analyze more samples, but Jamie Parker, a top official at the Fairbanks lab, says they're being strategic about which ones they do sequence.
We're looking to sequence specimens from as much of a diverse geographical region in the state as we can, so we can get an idea of what's happening all over the state as opposed to maybe just Fairbanks or Anchorage.
It's unlikely the state will be able to keep the new COVID-19 strain from getting to Alaska and taking hold there, says Dr. Tom Hennessy, an infectious disease epidemiologist with the University of Alaska Anchorage's College of Health. He says that makes it even more urgent to administer vaccine to healthcare workers and vulnerable Alaskans, which would be at the brunt of the impact of a faster spreading form of the virus when it does arrive.
We're in a race with it right now.
Ultimately, many people are likely to be infected with the new strain, but vaccinations can help ensure that at least healthcare workers are protected and that older Alaskans are less likely to get seriously ill. And that means hospitals would be less likely to be overwhelmed, Hennessy says.
That's what the vaccine can help us with at this point. It's probably not going to prevent this from spreading widely in society.
State health officials say that one positive thing could come out of their efforts to detect the new strain. They're getting more practice at genetic sequencing, which could help them in their work fighting other viruses like hepatitis or flu.
So it actually is a bit of a silver lining that we're able to differentiate specimens that way.
While crops aren't catching COVID-19, that doesn't mean that the business of farming hasn't changed on Kodiak. Just ask C.N. Allen and Gideon Saunders of Brightbox Farms.
There's a demand for locally grown produce. Supply chains with the pandemic were interrupted. Trucking was maxed out. They were moving product as fast as they could across the country, but also, you know, the barges. I mean, there was a lot of interruption in supply chain. They were moving things as fast as they could. I mean, I can't really speak to traditional farming. I'm not really connected with that, but a lot of the vendors and people within what we'll call the vertical farming industry have seen an absolute boon in production and demand for produce grown as close to the communities as possible. And so huge uptick in that.
Allen and Saunders had only just started their business when the pandemic was getting underway. Allen said that with the new challenges came new opportunities, particularly in the ways they reached customers.
We were really fortunate in that the pandemic was a good time for us to start our business. We started growing microgreens back in May and had those available for farmers markets, for some local restaurants, and for people to place orders online and then come pick up at the farm. And so for us, it was really more about just starting off meeting the needs of people here in Kodiak. And so for us, it's been a lot about connecting with our local stores. We sell product through Cost Savers because it's easy for people to get it. We were working with the co-op to sell products through them because they had a nice way for people to set regular orders and pick things up and then participating in the markets. And so now moving forward, we're going to continue to work with local retailers, have weekly pickups at the house for people who want to put in orders, and also work with the co-op. So really just whatever way we can to get product in their hands.
Brightbox Farms has another trick up its sleeve, the shrewd innovation of the most current technologies in hydroponic farming.
the exciting thing about advances in technology around LED lighting, full spectrum LED lighting, and then just efficient hydroponic systems, cleaner ingredients. And so when you combine all that for a location like Kodiak, anywhere in Alaska and, you know, northern regions, it's a perfect way to, you know, provide food sustainability to these northern regions. And I mean, the company that we've worked with, you know, they're sending their systems all over the world, but more and more are, you know, arriving in Canada and Wyoming and Minnesota. And you know, the hydroponics and the LED lighting are incredibly efficient. You know, we have a farm that can produce 1,000 heads of lettuce a week and only use 5 gallons of water a day to do that.
Those interested in learning more about Brightbox Farms' methods or simply to get some of their produce on your table can do so at brightboxfarms, all one word, .com. Have you ever worried that someone would enter your home and steal your washing machine? What about your Toyo stove? Well, maybe you should if you live in Bethel. Over the past few months, there have been a series of burglaries resulting in stolen stoves.
At the end of September, the Bethel Community Services Foundation was broken into. An employee discovered the lock on BCSF's shop was busted, and after investigation, found that a Toyo stove was missing, nothing else. Afterwards, Executive Director Michelle DeWitt said she tried to think positive thoughts.
The only hope I could have was that if somebody took an item like that, it was, you know, to keep their family warm or something like that. The second time that we were stolen from, I knew that wasn't the case.
The very next week, a different BCSF building, also located in the avenues, was broken into, and again, only a Toyo stove was taken. But this time, the nonprofit had prepared, setting up cameras around its building to catch a burglar in action. If only Mother Nature hadn't gotten in the way.
At the time that the person came and stole the Toyo stove, there was like a heavy dew.
Images show a thief exiting the building with a Toyo stove, but dew on the camera lens blurred the person's face.
Yeah, that was a very bad luck.
Believing it had lost its chance to recover the stolen stoves, BCSF shelled out nearly $5,000 to replace them. After that, DeWitt didn't hear much about Toyo stoves for a while.
Several weeks later, maybe even months later, I finally received a phone call that somebody thought that they had identified one of our stolen Toyos.
The call came from Lucas Salzburn, a Toyo stove dealer and mechanic in Bethel. That week, one of his customers had brought in 2 Toyos to be repaired, but there was something fishy about them. For example, one of them looked to be newer, but the oil line was cut.
Something you would do if you were trying to get it out in a hurry.
On top of that, Salzburn's customer told him that the stove had been purchased from somebody who wasn't one of the 3 authorized Toyo stove dealers in town.
And so I kind of got to thinking, like, I wonder if that stove in my shop is, you know, was purchased legitimately.
A few months prior, BCSF had let him know about their stove thefts. Putting 2 and 2 together, he called DeWitt and asked if she had recorded her Toyo stove's serial number before it was stolen. She had.
And it just happened that this one in my shop matched up with the stolen serial number.
The police arrived and took the 1 Toyo stove to return to BCSF, but there was no evidence that the other one was also stolen. That left Salzburn with a possible stolen stove and an uncomfortable conversation with his customer.
Super awkward. I settled with the best thing to do was just to return the other stove and discontinue our business relationship.
Police Chief Richard Simmons said 5 Toyo stove thefts have been reported since September, targeting organizations like BCSF and the Bethel Independent Baptist Church, but also private residences, mostly around the Avenue's neighborhood. Police have made 1 arrest and are following leads in the other cases. Simmons would not say whether the thefts are related, citing ongoing investigations. But he did say thieves often steal one type of commodity over and over again.
To find a bad guy that finds a niche that they're comfortable with, that's not uncommon. Because once you specialize a little bit, you get better at it.
Stealing Toyo stoves is not an easy task. the stoves weigh between 50 and 90 pounds, and they're not something you can just run in and grab. Grant Fairbanks, another Toyo stove dealer and mechanic in Bethel, says it takes at least 15 minutes to detach one from the wall without damaging it.
It seems like a long time for somebody to be in somebody's house and not worry about getting caught.
In some ways, though, Toyo stoves are the perfect commodity to steal. They're expensive and people need them. Plus, even if a stolen one is found, you have to prove it's yours by providing the serial number. Salzburn says most people, understandably, don't record that.
And it'd be the same as, like, you know, you don't know the serial number of your refrigerator or the serial number of your stovetop, you know? Like, you have something that you would not suspect that somebody's going to come in and take from you.
But with a rash of Toyo thefts, Bethel Police Chief Simmons recommends that everyone should record their serial numbers and call police immediately if it is stolen. He also asks that neighbors keep a watch out for each other and take pictures if they see anything. In Bethel, I'm Greg Kim.
Record your serial number. Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki is again moving to establish a buyback program for set net permits in Cook Inlet. The program would reduce the number of commercial set net fishermen on the east side of the inlet. Sabine Pooks in Kenai has more.
Proponents of the bill, like Kenai Peninsula Fishermen's Association Director Ken Coleman, says that's to reduce pressure and create a more sustainable fishery in an area that's been under stress for years.
Our thought was, is if we could reduce our numbers, then those who would be left behind in a reduction scenario, assuming that some people would leave the fishing community, that those that are left behind would have better chance for ongoing financial viability.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game closed the east side of Upper Cook Inlet set net fishery this summer, citing weak king salmon runs. The legislative session doesn't begin until January 19th, but Michicki pre-filed the bill last week, SB 29, showing his intent to introduce it once the session starts. He introduced a similar bill in 2019, but it stalled in the Senate early last year. The program would be voluntary and fishermen would enter in a lottery. And permit holders first have to vote on whether they want such a program established. The bill says the Alaska Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission would conduct an election among set net permit holders in April 2022. If the buyback idea is approved, the commission would not buy back more than 200 permits, about half of the 440 permits in the fishery. The program would buy each permit for $260,000. Coleman says a fisherman would likely get about $20,000 per permit today, if selling it on their own, from a high of $120,000. But the bill doesn't establish a mechanism for funding the buyback. Michicki says the money wouldn't come from the state.
I should make it clear that none of this is related to state funding. State doesn't have any money right now for this sort of thing. But they can't even approach other entities for possibly pitching in on this program until they're legally able to do it.
Michicki says a large coalition of support is behind the bill, citing surveys of set netters who expressed overwhelming approval. Opponents say they're not sure reducing the number of permit holders will make the fishery viable. Coleman says splitting the resource fewer ways will improve returns for the remaining fishermen.
I can tell you that when my neighbor doesn't fish, I have a pretty significant bump in my catch, an increase in my catch because they weren't in the water in front of me.
The bill would close waters to commercial fishing once permitters sell their holdings. Michicki says the idea is that set netters could move onto new sites or new work when they sell their permits. Alaska legislators have pre-filed 94 total bills in this first batch last week. We'll have a link to read the bill in its entirety in the online version of this story. For KDLL, I'm Sabine Pooks.
After 40 years of debate, just two companies and a state corporation showed up to the first ever oil and gas lease sale in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge last week. But still, about 500,000 acres of land was picked up, nearly all of it by the state of Alaska itself. So what happens next? Alaska Public Media's Tegan Hanlon has the story.
Let's start with what's next for the state-owned Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, also called ADA. ADA entered the lease sale at the last minute as a backstop in case no one else showed up to secure the rights to the land in the Arctic Refuge's coastal plain. And it wound up as the most aggressive of just three bidders.
We're very happy that we're able to win some of the tracks in this case.
That's Ada's executive director, Alan Weitzner. Ada won 9 tracts of land in the coastal plain in northeast Alaska by offering the minimum amount the federal government would accept, just $25 an acre.
We would have preferred to see a more competitive bid in place, but I do think that there was a lot of uncertainty related to it.
Oil industry analysts have speculated for months that few companies would show up to the lease sale because of all of the risks and all of the opposition. Weitzner says he hopes the state's decision to step in removes at least some of the uncertainty the oil industry might have about searching for oil in the coastal plain. Ada does not have drilling equipment, so it will likely have to partner with the industry at some point to explore for oil and to pump it out of the ground. As for when that might happen, Weitzner says,
it's too early to say and give that information of what our definitive plan is going forward.
For now, Weitzner says he's focused on paperwork so the federal government can finalize the oil leases. Meanwhile, the two small companies that each picked up a single lease say they saw opportunity in entering the Arctic Refuge early. Mark Graber manages one of the companies, Knik Arm Services.
I'm an investor, and I go where I think a fair investment might offer a decent return for the risk, relative to the risk.
Graber says he's putting up a good deal of his own money to purchase the lease, along with other funders that he declined to name. Like Ada, Knik Arm Services would also have to partner with the oil industry to do the actual drilling, which Graber says they'll do when the time is ripe. He says he has made investments during a down market before.
We always bought real estate during the real estate crash of 89. We've always tried to facilitate a weak market by taking the gamble and taking a risk. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
As for the environmental and indigenous groups that oppose drilling for oil in the refuge, they say they are not giving up. Carlin Itchock, Alaska State Director for the Wilderness Society, says the goal now is to stop the Trump administration from making any more progress.
We are going to do everything in our power to prevent the leases from being issued before Inauguration Day, and we're going to do everything we can to prevent oil and gas development from ever happening on the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge.
Itchock and other opponents expect support from the next administration. President-elect Joe Biden takes office January 20th. He says he opposes drilling in the refuge and will take immediate steps to protect the land. With help from reporter Nat Herz, I'm Tegan Hanlon in Anchorage.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Should the boards of fish and game push meetings to next year? Your input is wanted. More after this.
Seafood Auction says thanks to longline fishermen and seafood buyers for a successful 2020 season and looks forward to working together again in 2021. Learn more at seafoodauction.net.
Should Board of Fish and Board of Game meetings be pushed to next year? A joint board's committee wants to hear Alaskans' thoughts by Friday. Glenn Haight is board's director.
It can be looked at pretty simply. Should they just push all the meetings back a year, otherwise keeping things the same? And if you did that, what you essentially have is everyone's on a 4-year cycle for a little while. Or do you want to try to splice up, you know, the existing schedule into the next future years?
The boards focus on regional issues every 3 years. Scheduled for this March and April are 79 proposals for Prince William Sound fisheries, 155 for Southeast, and 42 for statewide shellfish. The public has given input since last fall on if the boards should hold their meetings virtually, in person, or at all.
But we were concerned that a lot of the attention we were getting were from participants this year's meetings, so folks from Prince William Sound and Southeast. But we want to make sure that the other regions know that if we have to postpone these meetings this year, it will impact other regions.
Scheduled for next year's meetings are fisheries at Bristol Bay, the Alaska Peninsula, and the Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim regions. Haight says bumping meetings for a year raises budget questions and tweaks the schedules of both boards.
Board of Fish and Board of Games schedules are synced. in such a way that a particular region isn't going to have to look at and address Board of Game proposals in the same year that they do Board of Fish. If we start to rearrange those schedules, it throws that out of whack.
Public comments are accepted through this Friday, January 15th.
If your positions change and you want to resubmit a new comment, that would be appreciated, but perhaps make a strong note that your position has changed so the board recognizes that when they look at it.
The January 19th Joint Committee meeting will be streamed live, but no public testimony will be taken. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Tuesday. It is the 12th day of January, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 9:45. It will set again at 4:53 this afternoon, giving us 7 hours and 8 minutes of daylight. That is a gain of 3 minutes and 1 second compared to yesterday. Looking at our local district tides, we have a high tide coming up here on the east side at 12:49 p.m. of 10.66 feet, followed by a low tide at 7:49 p.m. of minus 1.72 feet, a significant minus tide. The next high tide will be at 2:24 a.m. of 7.77 feet, followed by a low tide at 7:29 a.m. of 2.66 feet. But again, a massive low tide at 7:49 p.m. On the east side. Over on the west side, these are Uganic Pass tides. You have a high tide coming up at 1:23 p.m. of 16.9 feet, followed by a low tide at 8:11 p.m. of minus 2.9 feet. Your next high tide will be at 2:37 a.m. of 15.55 feet. And your morning low tide on the west side will be at 8:17 a.m. of 2.7 feet. Currently 35 degrees here in Kodiak. We're looking for a slight chance of rain showers tonight, mixing with snow after midnight, then gradually ending and becoming mostly cloudy with a low around 31 tonight. Mostly sunny skies tomorrow with a high near 39. And for tomorrow night, chance of snow showers after 9 p.m., mixing with rain after midnight tomorrow night, and mostly cloudy skies, a low around 32 tomorrow. Mariners, here's your synopsis for the North Gulf Coast, including Kodiak Island waters and Cook Inlet. A 970 millibar low, 130 nautical miles southwest of Kodiak City, will move this morning into Bristol Bay, and a strong front will enter the southern Gulf Thursday morning. So, Marmot Island Sitkanak, small craft advisory through Wednesday. Southeast winds to 20 knots and seas to 12 feet on Kodiak's east side offshore. For tomorrow, look for southwest 25, seas to 10 feet. And for Wednesday night, look for southeast 35, seas to 8 feet. Over in the Shelikof on Kodiak's west side, east winds to 20 knots right now and seas to 7 feet. For tomorrow, look for southwest winds to 20 knots and seas to 5 feet. And Thursday, look for northeast 50, seas to 26 feet in the Shelikof on Thursday. Inside waters, Chiniak and Marmot Bays, east wind to 15 knots, turning to southeast 10 knots this afternoon in Chiniak Bay, seas to 4 feet. For tomorrow, look for southwest 20, seas to 3 feet. In Marmot Bay, east winds to 20 knots right now, seas to 7 feet, should subside to 4 feet this afternoon. For tomorrow, look for southwest winds to 15 knots and seas to 3 feet in Marmot Bay. The Wednesday library trivia is still going on, 6:30 p.m. this Wednesday. The Zoom link is on the library's website and Facebook page, always great places to check out. If you have questions or need help, you can call Lori at 486-8688. Also, the winter poetry readings begin January 20th at 6 p.m. and continue through April. Contact Ani to share a poem and be a part of the monthly Zoom program. And that number is 486-8683. The library offers home delivery to those unable to get out of the house and curbside pickup at the side door as well. Call the library for this service. That goes on Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. You can also make an appointment to go to the library in person Monday through Saturday at 11 a.m., 1 p.m., and 3 p.m. for 90-minute visits. You must wear a mask and follow social distancing guidelines, and call 486-8686 for questions about that. Well, the City Council will be having a work session tonight at 7:30, and their regular meeting is on Thursday at 7:30. The Assembly is having an Assembly work session at Thursday at 6:30 p.m., and that is also, these are all happening online. Check their respective websites for links. The City Council meetings will be broadcast here on KMXT at 7:30 tonight and on Thursday. But the Assembly is having a work session on 6:30 p.m. on Thursday, followed by an Assembly special meeting that will be following the work session. For a link to join that, go to the Borough website.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.